Welcome to Soundbites, true stories told by local Mainers and nationally recognized storytellers. The themes are always changing and the hosts are from all over the nation, but when you hear the name Soundbites, you're in for a unique storytelling experience. Soundbites is made possible by the generous contributions of Allagash Brewing, Frontier, The Press Hotel, and by the listeners of Maine Public Radio. This week's stories were told live at Frontier in Brunswick, where the event's dedicated theme was Undertow. Here's today's host, a teacher, author, and storyteller from Connecticut, Matthew Dix.
So we're lucky because we have another storyteller ready to take the stage. Enormous round of applause, please, for Katie Rutherford, ladies and gentlemen.
Totally weird. So my name's Katie. I grew up in a family and in an environment, as many of us do, in which we're taught that you can do anything you put your mind to. I think it was also a factor of growing up in a family of three women, that especially if you fight hard enough and you're determined enough, you can accomplish anything you put your mind to, and especially when somebody tells you you can't do it. So that has filtered through my life and my sister's life in many different ways, through school and sports and relationships and careers. So when I was 23, I decided to start a nonprofit organization based in this tiny little village on the coast of South Africa that I'd been connected to in different ways. And so I went through the formalities of getting it incorporated and tax exempt and raising some money, and I decided to move to South Africa and get things going. So I moved in to my friend's backpackers lodge. I stayed there for free in exchange to like cook breakfast for backpackers, which everybody would inevitably order a poached egg, which is like the one thing, well, not the one thing I can't do, but I can't poach an egg. So I would give the backpackers rides, and I would spend a lot of my day in the village just talking to community leaders and getting into the school and reaching out to people that I'd been connected to before, to make sure that the programs were driven by the community and led by the community, and I was determined to make it work. So on the side of this backpacker's lodge was this tiny little shack where these two grandparents lived, and they were taking care of about seven grandchildren. And two of them were these brothers. They were 11 and 14, and they were in the school that I was starting to work with, so they really got interested in what I was doing and kind of started hanging out around me and shadowing me, and then I would kind of shadow them in the village, and they helped me out so much in developing trust in the village, and we sort of started joking that they were like my little brothers and I was their big sister, and they had told me that their mother wasn't around, that they had learned so many wonderful lessons from her, you know, to stay in school and to work hard and to stay away from drugs, but she had since struggled with drugs and had been very absent from their lives, and they hadn't seen her in a few years. And their grandparents were kind of abusive, so naturally I was trying to just kind of gently be a positive resource in their life, and I made sure they were doing their homework and not hanging out at the bar at the backpackers every night and getting to school. And we became this little family unit in this like really funny way. They were such a huge part of the work that I was doing. So one morning I'm trying to poach an egg unsuccessfully, and the boy's older cousin runs up to me in like this panic, and he's like, Katie, you have to drive us to the hospital in Knysna, which is like an hour and a half away. There's been a horrible tragedy, and we need to get in the car, because I was one of the few people with the car. And so I was like, yeah, let's get, well, you know, I'm immediately thinking the worst. And he says, it's the boy's mother. There's been a terrible attack, and basically somebody had targeted the family and filled up a big empty beer bottle with gasoline and lit it on fire and threw it into this shack that the boy's mother had been staying in the village. So like eight of us pile into this tiny little car, and there's so much panic. They're all part of the same family, and the boys are there, and I can sense that, you know, they're starting to just kind of listen and figure out what's going on, and they're getting really scared. And I'm only picking up little pieces of it because they're speaking in Afrikaans, and it's a really long drive. So we get to this hospital, and it's not like anything we're used to. You know, there's no reception area or check-in. It's a very underfunded government hospital, and so we're just kind of like, you just like go in and you start running through the halls trying to find this woman. So we get to the correct floor, and one of the nurses sees us running, and she turns in the right direction of the room, and I'm kind of, you know, I understand my place in this. I'm giving the family a ride, and I'm trying to sort of keep my, you know, the appropriate distance and let them sort of face what they were about to be faced with. And I'm right behind them, sort of behind this like crowd of eight people, and everybody kind of walks in, and the youngest little brother is right in front of me, and I'm getting ready to kind of be there, and he whips around and wraps his arms around my neck and starts crying in my shoulder, and he's completely frozen and can't go in the room because he's just too scared. And I'm immediately sort of like, this wave kind of hits me of, you know, of course I care about these boys. Obviously I've developed this relationship with them, but I think it was like immediate fear of this like big sister, little brother relationship is much more significant than I had realized. So we get through that. I help him get into the room and at least be able to see his mother, because she's completely wrapped up. You can see nothing really but her eyes. She couldn't really talk at that point. But we get through that first visit, and I do the only thing I know that I can possibly do in this situation after we leave the hospital, and I go straight back to the village, and I'm like, okay, if they're going to be going through this emotionally, I'm going to go straight to the house, and I'm going to call the police, and I'm going to get somebody here, and we're going to hold somebody accountable. And so I get on the phone, and this tiny little shack is still kind of like smoking, and people are walking around and like picking stuff up, and you know, I'm thinking like, I've never been at a crime scene, but I'm like, I get on the phone and I'm like, you guys got to get here. We got to tape this off. You have to take fingerprints, and we have to make, you know, reassure the community that this can't happen. And the police like immediately dismiss me. And I think part of it was because they could tell from my accent that I was foreign, and the other part of it was just this happens all the time in the village, so they just didn't care. And nobody came. And so the next few weeks, you know, were filled with going to the hospital and taking different family members and trying to just be with the boys as often as I could. And I really kind of took my focus off of these programs that I was trying to get started and just tried to spend as much time as I could with them, and take them to the beach and do some things that were fun and talk about their mother and try to help them sort of process some of the stories that they could remember, so that they could preserve those good memories just in case, you know, the worst happened. And things were going okay, and we you know, it had been many weeks, and we thought, I sort of got to the point where we almost got into this comfort where I thought she was going to come out of it because it had been so many weeks, and she was still in the hospital. And the morning of Mother's Day, we got the call that she had passed away. And the boys never got a chance to sort of take that one last trip because it was quite far. And immediately, because the municipality had gotten involved in what was going on, they realized that these grandparents were taking care of way too many kids in their custody. And so the boys were at risk of becoming like wards of the state and sent off to who knows where and kind of fall through the cracks, as that happens with many children in South Africa. So I immediately become like angry and frustrated that this is like, I came here thinking, you know, I can start these programs and I can do anything, and I'm gonna work hard enough, and you know, I'm gonna fix this. I'm gonna fix what's going on in the village, and we're gonna do it responsibly. And I understood my limitations, but I thought if I worked hard enough and we, you know, got enough people involved, that we would be able to do it. And this was something that I couldn't fix. There was nothing I could do, no amount I could pay or nothing I could do to fight this. This is gonna be something that these boys were gonna have to live with. And I couldn't change that. And I was so mad because I always thought I could do whatever I put my mind to. So immediately, you know, the immediate weeks after, we end up finding a safe housing situation for the boys. I had sort of toyed with the idea that maybe, you know, I'm not one to say, everything happens for a reason, or like if you can change one person's life, it's all worth it. It's like a really nice sentiment and I appreciate it, but like I can't stand it. So I was like, okay, but maybe this is why I'm here. Maybe I'm not here for this organization. Maybe my purpose is to be a parent to teenagers. And I quickly realized that I didn't really have the skills or tools to do that either. So we did find a safe living situation for the boys. And for the next 4 years, they were still by my side, and they were a part of every single program that we did in the village. They got, you know, the parents involved and the other kids involved, and we all sort of built these programs together. And they grew up and they finished high school. And when I eventually obviously came back to the United States, and my life sort of went on quite easily. And when I think back on that time and I think about the failures and the things I wish I would have done differently, I still wish I could have made that situation better for them. But I think it's not about the solution that you can find in the moment or how settled you can become with, you know, this decision or this goal and whatever you're achieving. It's more about not turning our backs on each other. And we, you know, the three of us kind of got swept in and pulled under in different ways by this, but we got out of it together. Thanks.
Most of Katie's tells are in the form of grant writing or to a small group of friends around her sister's fire pit, which sounds much better. However, she has performed live during a pretend moth slam with her niece and nephew. When Katie is not spending her time working as a professional fundraiser for a cause that is very important to her, she can be found getting extremely fired up about politics or fulfilling a pact she made with her niece to always agree to a surprise dance in the streets in the style of La La Land.
Join us now for a conversation before the tell backstage. Our storyteller talked with the host to give us some interesting facts about them.
Katie, can you tell me your connection to Maine?
So my sister was pregnant with my nephew when I was graduating college, so I wanted to be around for that, so I came to Maine.
And it just stuck.
Yes. Yeah. I loved it here. I mean, I moved away and I've since come back, but it's been my home base since I was 22.
I love that. I love how people end up in places for reasons they could never expect. That's great. Can you tell me how you got into storytelling then?
I didn't, not necessarily professionally into storytelling, but Donna got me into this, and I've always loved the moth, and I've always enjoyed telling stories to my niece and nephew. They always want to hear crazy bedtime stories. So
they brought you to Maine, and they got you into storytelling.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, hopefully we'll keep going with it.
All right, so what is your process for preparing to tell a story?
This is the first time I've really done it in this form, so it involved a lot of like recording bad versions and sending them to Donna and then like freaking out because I was running out of time. So that was sort of my, I would say, my formal process, but it could use a little fine tuning, I suppose.
I think that's the process for many a professional storyteller. Yes. Yeah. Bad recordings and rushes and like last minute saves.
Yeah. And thinking that you're like doing it in a good amount of time and then realizing that it's like 20 minutes too long.
Yes. Well, of course. Yes, absolutely. It's only a cruel producer that ruins our stories with their time limits, really. So never think it's your fault. It is always the fault of someone who thinks that a story should have a time limit. I'm also a producer and often feel that way, but not tonight, surprisingly. I feel I should have hours. Can you tell me about one part of your story, sort of a behind-the-scenes detail that didn't appear in tonight's story that could have been included had the producer given you a little more time?
Yeah, so I talk about two brothers in my story, and a few weeks ago they sent me pictures of their children, and that was really nice to receive and sort of goes along with the story once you hear it. So,
all right, that's great. Thanks, Katie.
Soundbites is made possible by the generous contributions of Allagash Brewing, Frontier, The Press Hotel, and by the listeners of Maine Public Radio. Special thanks also to Toad & Co. More information about Soundbites, including how to attend a live storytelling event, is online at soundbitesme.org. And of course, you can always hear more stories at mainepublic.org.